This week, we commence the Torah's discussions of the Mishkan and related matters. It will span over the better part of 5 weeks. We ourselves will take a couple of weeks out to discuss in Yanei Purim, but certainly for this evening we have before us the first of the Parshas, which is Parshas Trumas. A great deal to talk about, and from a great many points of view. Of course, there are the technical aspects, and there are the symbolic aspects, and the two are very much connected to each other. One of the first items of note with regards to the Mishkan are referred to as the Torah lists off the basic component parts and the ingredients for the Mishkan in the end of Pasuk He. The Pasuk He of Perek Kaf He, these are the materials to be gathered. The Oros Elim, Ma'adomim, those are ram skins, the Oros Tachoshim, the skins of the Tachash, which we've discussed on other occasions. Va'atzei Shitim, and the cedar wood. Now the cedar wood, of course, will be used for the beams. And Rashi, and his source is the Medrash Tanchuma in this week's Parsha, gives us the background to these Atzei Shitim, these cedar trees, which then became the beams. Rashi states, Umei'ayin hayulahem bamidbar. From where did they have these trees in the desert? Pirush Rabbi Tanchuma, Rashi quotes Rabbi Tanchuma, Yaakov Avinu, Tzafa Beruach HaKodesh. So Yaakov saw with divine spirit, She'asidin Yisrael Livnos Mishkan Bamidbar. So he knows in the future that the Jewish people, his descendants, they will build the Mishkan in the desert. So he prepared. He brought these cedar trees to Mitzrayim. That means he brought them from Eretz Yisrael. It's very interesting. Of all of the component parts of the Mishkan, the only exported materials from Eretz Yisrael were the Atzei Shitim. Everything else was courtesy, largely, of the Egyptians, who some of whom were still waiting for it to come back to them. Unita'am. And he planted them in Mitzrayim, v'tziva lebanav itlam imahem, and he commanded his sons to take them with them, kishiyetzu'u mimitzrayim. So this is a wonderful background to the Mishkan, the Atzei Shittim. Yaakov has been planting them, and it's been getting it ready, and that's where they got them from. Now, as we know, Rashi's job, of course, is Liyashiv Pshuto Shel Mikra. That's the mission that he has stated for himself. Any information Rashi gives us somehow will need to be grounded in, or at least a response to a pshat consideration. Here, the pasuk says, Atzei Shitim, or cedar trees. That's all you know, and all you need to know. We may ask, what did Rashi see? Ma ro'o al kocha, to feel that he needs to fill us into the background? Is there a problem here? Is there something that one needs to respond to? It's interesting. What is considered a pshat issue? After all, the words are okay. So on the simplest level, of course, Rashi would be bothered by the question, how are they going to get hold of all of these cedar trees when they're in the middle of the wilderness? Lo makom zera. It's not a place where you expect those things to find them, and you need a lot of them. So it seems to be a logistical issue. The words are fine, just where's the wood coming from? And Rashi himself seems to tip us off, so to speak, that this is his issue, because Rashi raises the question. He doesn't ask, Umei'ayin hayulahem eitzim, from where did they have wood, which would be merely a curiosity. But he phrases the question, Umei'ayin hayalahem bamidbar. Where did they get it in the desert? When you phrase that question, you also show your hand. That's really what's bothering you, is that if you're in the middle of the desert, where are you going to find Atzei Shitim? So clearly, as far as Rashi is concerned, there is no natural way they're going to find them in the desert. They must have brought them with them from Mitzrayim. Once that's true, if that's an intuitive turn now, they must have brought them with them. There's no way that they brought them with them unless they were directed to do so. Because of all the things that one would like to pack when going on a journey into the desert, 40-foot beams of wood are not they're not that travel friendly. And therefore, if we must conclude that they brought them with them, there's no way that they did so unless they were directed to do so, and therefore the ground is fertile here for bringing in the words of Rabbi Tanchuma, that indeed they were told to bring them, and then we have the whole background. Actually, Yaakov brought them originally, and he planted them, and he directed them, and that's where they came from. Interesting that although Rashi hasn't really discussed the words of the Psukim yet, but from the Tanchuma we will see that there is actually evidence within the Pasuk itself that there is a certain background to these beams. And that's to be found not here, but a bit later into the Parsha, Perek Kafvav, Pasuk Tesvav, which is when the beams are discussed. Perek Kafvav, Pasuk Tesvav. One of them we should be able to spot instantly, and the other will accompany it. Pasuk Tesvav reads, it's discussed all the kelim and all of the curtains and the coverings, and then the Pasuk says, Ve'asisa es hakrashim la mishkan. Translate literally, you will make the beams, or fashion form, the beams for the mishkan. This is the only item that we have in the Parsha as such, which is stated with the hey hayadia, with the definite article. Everything else, make an aron, make a menorah, make a paroches, and make the coverings, yirios. Here, it doesn't say v'asisa krashim lamishkan. It says v'asisa es hakrashim lamishkan. The hey hayadia is the definite article. That means that the pasuk is telling us that these are known. How are they known? Because it's a very special background. Everything else, they bought from what they had, but they weren't dedicated for this. They weren't prepared for this. These beams were prepared for this, and therefore, they're a known entity. Thus, the Pasuk says, Es Hakrashim. What's fascinating, of course, is that once the Medrash tells us that we know about them, the Pasuk is telling us that we know about them, but the Pasuk doesn't tell us how we know about them. The Medrash tells us how we know about them, but the Pasuk says, you know. Which is a very interesting interplay, so to speak, between essentially Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebal Peh. Torah Shebichtav, the Pasuk doesn't tell you where these beams came from. It just tells you that you know where they came from. That much it says. And what do you know? That you have from Torah Shebal Peh. That means that the Torah Shebichtav will refer to information transmitted orally. It will reference it as known. But of course you need the Masorah in order to know. That's very interesting. It's very similar to the Halachas of Shechita, where it says in Parshas Re'eh, Hashem says that you shall do Vezavachta Kasher Tzivisicha, as I've commanded you. There's no reference in the Torah to any commands of how to do Shechita. It's just Vezavachta. The reference, of course, are to the set of halachas of Shechita, which were transmitted orally. They're not recorded in the Torah, but the Torah does refer to them as things that you have been told, and that's part of the harmony, the shleimus of Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebal Peh. So thus far, the Pasuk itself is indicating to us that we know the background of these beams from the Hey Hayadia es Hakrashim. And then, says the Medrash Tanchuma, the Pasuk goes on to say, Atse Shitim Omdim. Now, Atse Shitim, once again, are the cedar trees. Omdim, standing. What is the meaning of standing? Well, on a simple level, standing means they've got to be upright, which, is, by the way, is not the only way that they could have been arranged. They could have been side by side, one on top of the other. But nonetheless, the Medrash goes further with its explanation and says that the meaning of the word omdim, for omdim can physically mean standing, or omdim means that it can, something is ready for something. You say it is omed lekach. And the Medrash says that these are the krashim, atzishitim omdim. These trees have been waiting for this. They've been ready for this. They're omdim for the Mishkan for all these decades and indeed centuries. So that's the filling in from the psukim that the Tanchuma gives. Rashi, in his commentary to that pasuk, actually makes reference to to these points, but he doesn't see them as the compelling points initially when he gives us the background. Apparently it's enough just to raise the question, where would they get the cedar trees in the Midbar? Now, this is how things would seem to rest until we consult the words of the Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra, and we'll see just how bothered he was by one word, essentially, and we'll see what it spawned. Ibn Ezra says, he quotes the Midrash, Ibn Ezra knows all of the Midrashim, but he has a problem. The problem is, later on in Parshas Vayakhel, and of course we have the benefit of the before and after, we see as it should be and as it is. In Perek Lamed Hei, Pasuk Kaf Dalet, when it talks about the giving of the materials, so the Pasuk reads, so this is the section where everyone who had, they gave. Pasuk Kaf Dalet of Perek Lamed Hei, Kol Meirim Trumas Kesef Unochoshes Hevias Trumas Hashem, all those who gave those donations and of silver and copper, V'chol Asher Nimtza Ito Atzei Shittim V'chol Meleches Ha'avodah Hevi. Again, the words V'chol Asher Nimtza Ito Atzei Shittim, and anyone who had with him Atzei Shittim. Now the Ibn Ezra looks at these words, Asher Nimtza Ito, and he draws what for him is a clear conclusion. The word Asher Nimtza Ito means these were things, that items that he had with him, just because he had them, for his own purposes. They were with him, and then he gave from his property. Nimtza Ito, says the Ibn Ezra, sounds like litzarko. These are things that he somehow had in his possession. No one gave them to him, and he didn't take them originally for the Mishkan. He took them originally for himself. He has them, and now he's giving them to the Mishkan. That doesn't sound like the Medrash, which says that no one really had these things for themselves. I mean, they took them from the outset expressly for the Mishkan. And therefore, it sounds like they had them. On the other hand, says Ibn Ezra, if they had them, I'm sure they didn't take them from Egypt. In that respect, he's very much like everyone else. There's no way that they would spontaneously decide to take these things out of Mitzrayim. So, where does this leave us? And therefore, Ibn Ezra forges for himself a new way of understanding, a new possibility as to where these beams came from. But I would like to stress and emphasize what he emphasizes. He prefaces his explanation. Now we know Ibn Ezra is not a stranger to explaining things radically different than what you'll find in Rashi or the Medrash. But hear these words, because we've got to hear the full Ibn Ezra. Before he embarks on his explanation, he says, Vihine, lo yadanu. He's quoted the Medrash and then comments. We don't know, I don't know, we don't know. Im kabbalah haisabiyad avoseinu, if there is a kabbalah, a tradition that our fathers had, shemi mitzrayim hotziyum, that they took them from Mitzrayim. Gamanachnu nasur el mishmata. If it is a kabbalah, if they have a tradition, says Ibn Ezra, so then my comment is finished on this pasuk, because what's to talk about? What would I try and reinvent or invent in terms of supposing what may have happened when we have a tradition in terms of what did happen? So if it's a Kabbalah, so then that's the answer. They know through tradition that they came from Egypt, then they came from Egypt. I'm not going to say otherwise. But I'm not sure whether this comment is sourced in a tradition. The Medrash says it, but the Medrash may be saying it by means of interpretation. Maybe the Medrash, this is the analysis of the Medrash. Could be. The imsvarahi, if this is something that the Medrash thinks, yesh levakesh derech acheres, then I feel that I am entitled to state my thoughts. It's a very important statement of the Ibn Ezra, because essentially now, although the Ibn Ezra is famous almost on a superficial level for having his own way of explaining the psukim, and it's not like the Medrash, etc. and so forth. You see from the Ibn Ezra himself that there are certain rules for this that are very clear to him. He divides the comments of the Medrash broadly into two categories: Kabbalas, Rabbeinu, and Perush Rabbeinu. If it's a Kabbalah, says Ibn Ezra, it's entirely unreasonable for me to try and present a version of things when we know. But if it's a Perush, so then that's Kedarka Shel Torah. That's the way of Torah that Chazal are obviously give their Perush, but that doesn't mean that no one else can give their Perush. From this point of view, we should state that the Ibn Ezra, in principle, is no different than anyone else in his approach, because he acts no differently, not than the Ramban, and also not than Rashi. For you'll find it throughout the works of Rashi and the Ramban, that they will often quote Chazal in the Medrash and then give their own explanation. They just didn't become as famous for it as the Ibn Ezra, but in form and in principle, they're all following the same. What may happen sometimes as a machlokus between Ramban, for example, and Ibn Ezra, is whether something really was a Kabbalah, which means it's off limits, or it was a Perush, in which case one has license to also give a Perush. Ramban, for example, takes Ibn Ezra to task over his interpretation of Nimrod back in the end of Parshas Noah. Who was Nimrod? How does the pasuk refer to him? Gibor Chayil lifnei Hashem. Doesn't sound too bad. So, now what? So we know from Rashi that this is all terrible, right? That he just wants to lifnei Hashem. He wants to take people away from monotheism. Ibn Ezra says he sounds like he was okay. It sounds pretty good, actually. And the Ramban takes him to task. Ramban says, "What do you mean? We have a Kabbalah from Chazal. We know about Nimrod, and we know that he was a bad person, and therefore there's no room for alternative interpretation." Clearly, there, where Ramban and Ibn Ezra are parting ways, are on this question itself: was it a Kabbalah, or was it a Perush of Chazal? Im Kabbalah, nekabel. If it's a Perush, so there's room yet for us to give a Perush. So, acharei hadvarim ha'eleh, having introduced this way, says Ibn Ezra, it seems to me that where did the Jewish people get these beams from? They got them from the desert. How do you get beams? How do you get cedar trees from a desert? There was a cedar forest in the desert. There are forests in the desert. It's not famous for its forest, but it's possible. And they had actually cut down many of these cedar trees. They had essentially forested the entire area for other reasons before it came to the Mishkan. Now you may be wondering, what are these other reasons? Why have they been cutting down all of these trees even before anyone spoke about the Mishkan? Well, the answer to that is to be found in the words of the Ibn Ezra elsewhere. Earlier on, in Parshas Beshalach, the Ibn Ezra makes another of these types of comments. And he says, you know, there's the Medrash talks about the fact that the Jewish people were surrounded and protected by the Anani HaKovod. The Pasuk doesn't explicitly talk about the Anani HaKovod. And therefore, but if there were no Anani HaKovod, you may ask, even though we weren't asking, but you may ask, so how would they be protected? I mean, they're in the middle of the desert. Where are they living? Well, it seems to me, says Ibn Ezra, that when they came to Har Sinai, as long as they're traveling a few days here, a few days there, and on the way to Har Sinai, so then there's not much point in setting up anything too enterprising. But when they came to Har Sinai, and they're at Har Sinai for a year, close to a year, my understanding is that that was the point that they began to construct for themselves more significant structures from wood, and this is where the forest, the cedar forest, comes in. Near Sinai, somewhere, somehow, there was the cedar forest. They cut them all down, and they made sukkos, which means for his trouble that Ben Ezra says this is his understanding of where Chag HaSukkos comes from, Basukos of Shavti, Sukkos Mamash, wood structures. Okay. And we should be interested to know that they had surplus wood. Because they cut that whole thing and they made Sukkos for themselves and they had wood left over. That's the wood that we, about which we say, Asher Nimtza Ito, that they gave over to the Mishkan. So it's all worked out. The only thing is, Ibn Ezra is working this entire interpretation, the necessity to make these sukkos, he himself has said, is working on the presumption that they have no other protection, otherwise known to us as Anani HaKavod. Except, but Chazal do talk about the Anani HaKavod. So what about that? So these are the words of the Ibn Ezra there. V'im kabolahi, if it's a tradition, sheshiva anani hakovet hayu, that the word is anani hakovet, naniach svarasenu, we will abandon our entire approach, v'nesmochala kabbalah, we'll rely on the tradition. So in other words, these two comments of the Ibn Ezra, they have the same thing in common, in the sense that if they didn't come from Mitzrayim, if that's not a Kabbalah, then they need to have come from the Midbar. But why would they need them? They'd need them to make Sukkos, which is if they don't have their Anani HaKavod, assuming that's not a Kabbalah. And therefore, they're reliant on each other on a double lack of Kabbalahs, if that's so. But in both cases, Ibn Ezra says, I'm only saying what I'm saying if there's no tradition. If there is, says Ibn Ezra, I'll be the first to direct you towards the Kabbalah. If not, that's my suggestion. Of course, we should note that whereas the Ibn Ezra is alerting us to the fact that there is no reference in the Pasuk to the explicit reference to the Anani HaKavod, quite so, he can't deny the fact that there is also no explicit reference in the Pasuk to a cedar forest next to Har Sinai, which is also so, okay. But we should remember that what got the Ibn Ezra going on this whole issue was one word, and that is that the Pasuk talks about these cedar trees in the possession of the Jewish people as Nimtza Ito. For the Ibn Ezra, that compellingly and overwhelmingly sounds like they had them for other reasons, for their own reasons. And says Ibn Ezra, if that's true, you've got to find out, Seyu Lamad, what are those other reasons? His entire Perush stands on that inflection of the word Ito. And we should know that there are Mefarshe Rashi, who very brusquely push away that understanding of the word Ito. The Mizrahi, or Eliyahu Mizrahi, quotes they all quote the Ibn Ezra. He quotes the Ibn Ezra, and says, he says the Ito means for his own purposes, says Mizrahi, I'm not convinced. Ito means it's with him. Some people had them with them. Does it mean that they were for their own purposes? No. Ito means they were in their possession. Quite so. But for what purpose? For the Mishkan, as Rashi said. Which means that the war is on this word of Ito. From that, everything else will follow. Just to mention in conclusion with regards to this part of the discussion, although I believe it's a major discussion, especially in terms of the Ibn Ezra, who very often is less than fully understood in terms of his approach. People tend to focus on the sensationalist excerpts from the Ibn Ezra, and they do him a disservice because he himself sets out exactly what his parameters are. But in any case, the notion itself, acharei hadvar ma'ila, after all the parshanot work is done. You have these trees. I mean, Yaakov, he schlepped them down from Eretz Canaan, and he's planting them. I mean, that's a long time in preparation. And if he hadn't done that, they'll be without trees? But presumably not. I mean, he knows that it's interesting. He knows there'll be a Mishkan. And it's also interesting, this is a parenthetical comment because it's really a spark from a different discussion, that according to Rashi, there was no talk of the Mishkan until after the Chet HaEgel. Unlike the Ramban, who sees the Parshas Kisidram, and the original Tzivoy was before the Egel, it got shelved and then was brought back. But according to Rashi, in Mukdam HaMu'ucha B'Torah, once again you have that Machlokas, and therefore none of it really happened before the Egel. It was all after the Egel. But there's many different ways to understand what it means to say that the Mishkan was only ever mentioned after the Egel. That means it's a response to the Egel, its time wasn't right until the Egel, has something gone wrong? from Rashi, I think, just in terms of the consistency, you see clearly that it's not a negative statement that there was no Egel, there's no Mishkan until after the Egel, because if it's a negative sign that something's gone terribly wrong and hence the Mishkan, so I don't think Yaakov would have really instilled that into the consciousness of his descendants before the fact and had them grooming something that's only a response to a recovery from a bad situation. But in any case, what's the goal? Why would Yaakov take such pains to do this? So Yaakov Kamenetsky says a very wonderful thing. And Yaakov is aware they're going into Golos, very, very difficult times ahead, and for a long time, decades. He brings with him a message of Geula. He'll tell them, V'alokim pakod yivkod eschem. But words help, but there's only so much they can do. There is a certain level of instilling into the consciousness of the Jewish people that they will be redeemed, that you cannot compare a speech with a tree. When Yaakov says you'll be redeemed, he's not just saying sometime in the future you'll be redeemed. He's saying you'll be redeemed, and these are the trees. Take care of them. That physical manifestation in the present, to be tended to and to be nurtured and to keep with them, it keeps the idea of Geula alive in a way that perhaps otherwise they just wouldn't have gone the distance. Idea. Sometimes an idea can fade, but the tree's still there and the idea stays there. Very wonderful idea. And in fact, this is Rabbi Yaakov Lishitoso, so to speak. This is his explanation, also his insight into the brachos that Yaakov gave, Parshas Vayechi, to many of the sons, he's discussing with them the future, long into the future, where they will be, lechof yamim, and etc. You'll be living here, and you'll be doing this. He's talking to them about things that don't exist for them now. It's not just im einach shavei masa. He won't be them at the time. You can't compare knowledge in principle that the Jewish people would be redeemed as opposed to the detailed and personalized knowledge of what you will do when you live in Israel. Where will you live? What will your role be? It takes on an altogether different type of crystallization, which also kept the idea of Geula alive together with the Jewish people. So these are the two ideas that are very closely related of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, and those are opening comments with regards to the Atzishit. Now, I'd like to take a look at one of the Kalim of the Mishkan. It's one of the Kalim that for various reasons it gets lost between the two Kalim on either side, or can be, and that is the Shulchan. The first kli that you'll meet is the Aron, and there's so much to say, and then if the menorah is going to come soon, and there's so much to say, and in between is the Shulchan. So, that is mentioned in Perek Kaf Hei, Pasuk Kaf Gimel. V'asisa Shulchan, Atzei Shittim, Amasai Mako, Amarachba, Mavachesi Kamaso, gives you the dimensions, and of course there's a lot of appurtenances to the Shulchan, and on it is the Lechem Hapanim. Now interestingly, the Ramban saw as in place to describe or explain the function of the Shulchan. It's interesting to consider, of all the things in the Mishkan, it seems to be the least avoda-like, in the sense that what you did with it doesn't seem to be look like a korban. The lechem upon them were put on it, and then they were taken off after a week and then eaten by the kohen. Nothing was offered up per se. It's not like oil was consumed or incense was consumed or korbanos. Nothing was offered up on the shulchan itself. And Ramban explains. To hear his words, a couple of lines. Shezesh sod ha-shulchan. This is the deeper understanding, the inner understanding of what the shulchan is. Ki birkas Hashem, me'es hayos ha'olam, for blessing from Hashem, and divine influence. From the time the world is created, lo nivra yesh mi'ayin. You do not see ex nihilo. You don't see something from nothing anymore. Well, olam kemenhago noheg, whatever exists, exists. Things don't come to exist out of nothing. So where does bracha come from? After all, bracha, you're looking for an increase. Aval, kasher yiyesham, shorish davar. If you have some base material, some core material, tachul alav habracha v'tosif bo, bracha will fall onto it and increase it. In other words, bracha no longer, divine input of the world from the time of the creation, no longer takes the form of something from nothing. It will always be something more from something there. And he quotes a classic example of Elisha, with, I think it's the Haftarah for Parshas Vayera, where he says to that woman, she says nothing, and the creditors are coming, and they have nothing there. He says, well, do you have anything? Hagidili, ma'esh lach babayis? Do you have anything? So she said she has asuch shemen. She has one small flask of oil, which is hardly going to keep anyone very happy for very long. But Elisha, of course, said to her, put it in a room, as many empty vessels as you can bring in. And she opened up, the whole thing was overflowing with oil. But she needed something. It wasn't nothing. But whatever it was, then Birchas Hashem would expand it and increase it. Says Ramban, that's the idea. So, v'chein ha'shulchan belechem aponim. This is the concept. After all, the Mishkan is the center of Hashem's connection with the world. And putting the lechem upon him, on the shulchan, botachul habracha. That's the core material. That's the something. And from there, bracha will come, umimenu yavo hasova lechol Yisrael. And from there will come prosperity and satiation to all of Yisrael. So Ramban is explaining the lechem upon him. There's got to be something there. And from that small amount will come a great amount. We note, of course, the Ramban is extending the idea from Elisha, because in that instance, the oil itself increased and became more oil. Here, in the Lechem Aponim, it's not that the bread becomes more bread. It's much more, in a sense, abstract, but it's because it's from the Mishkan itself. From those 12 loaves of bread comes then, emanates the ribui, the prosperity for the rest of Yisrael. So this is the Shulchan, which has the sod of the Shulchan, as the Ramban says. We note that the Shulchan also has an aspect which Rashi, because it has a zer, it has a crown. And when we hear crown, so we're mindful instantly of the Keser Torah and Keser Kuna and Keser Malchus. Rashi quotes on Pasuk Kaf Dalet, Zer Zahav, Simon le Keser Malchus. This is a sign, this crown, on the Shulchan for Keser Malchus. What's the table got to do with Malchus? Shah Shulchan Shem Osher Ugedula. The Shulchan represents wealth, greatness, Kamosha Omrim, like we say. Who says? We say, like people say, Shulchan Malachim. Shulchan Malachim, it's a catchphrase, but for Rashi, it caught a truth. Shulchan Malachim is the Shulchan, therefore represents Gedula. And as we referenced, these are the three kesarim, the three crowns, for the three domains. You have the shulchan, which represents keser malchus, then you have the oran, that represents keser Torah, and the mizbeach, the golden mizbeach, which also has its zer, which represents keser kuhuna. And now the Maharal says something absolutely fascinating. Parshas Truma, of course, everything about the Mishkan is very symbolic. Maharal is symbolic even not in the Mishkan. So when the two meet, obviously something is going to happen. This is the comment of the Maharal in his Perek Tepirkei Avos, in the sixth Perek, is Derech HaChaim. There, the Pirkei Avos itself compares and contrasts Torah with Malchus and Kahuna Gedola Torah. Why is Gedola Torah? Because, says Pirkei Avos, see how many things come together with it. Kahuna is nicknames be'esrim ve'arba malos. You have 24 things that come together with it. They are the 24 matnos Kahuna. Malchus b'shlashim. Malchus with 30. These are the 30 things that Rashi explains. That Shmuel, when the people asked for a king in the time of Shmuel, so Shmuel told them exactly what a king would be like, and told them the 30 things that the king can do with them. And apparently he wasn't just scaring them. They're all true. These are the Shlosha Milas of Kahuna. That's actually a discussion in the Gemara in Sanhedrin in the second parrot. Do these things, are they true? Or was he saying them perhaps to inhibit them? Well, Rashi understands that the Pirkei Avos here is saying, no, these are Shloshim Malus. But when it comes to Torah, Torah Niknes B'Arbaim V'Shmona Devarim, with 48 things. So it's a very interesting, we're not here to discuss the Pirkei Avos there, but it's a very interesting comparison. This is 24, and this is 30, and this is 48, because these numbers are not the same. I mean, they're not talking in the same currency. The first two, about the 24 and the 30, they are things that accrue to these institutions if you have them. If you're a Kohen, you get these 24 things. But how do you get to be a Kohen? Because your father was a Kohen, as I'm sure you know the story. And if you're the Melech, you get these 30 things. How do you get to be the Melech? However you got to be the Melech. The 48 things of Torah, they're not, if you have Torah, you have these 48 things. These are 48 things that you need in order to get Torah. And even in the words of Pirkei Avos, you can see, the first two, it spoke about Malos, Esrim Vavar Malos, Shloshim Malos, the Torah, Nikles B'memches Devarim, not Malos. It's a very interesting point of comparison. Torah is greater. For the first two things, you get these such and such amount. For Torah, you need to do much, much more. That's what makes it greater. It's a very interesting point of contrast. In any case, what we do see is that you have the areas of Kahuna, Malchus, and Torah, and they have these Malos, or Dvarim, attached to them. It says Maharal, these are all embedded in the measurements of the Mishkan, of these the relevant Kalim in the Mishkan. Let's see how. Well, of course, the only thing we need to know is that when we talk about an amma is six tvachim, six handbreadths. And therefore, says Maharal, if you tally up the perimeter around the various kalim, you will find that the perimeter of each kli will give you the critical amount, the relevant amount for that. For example, says Maharal, the Mizbech HaKetores, so that has a crown that corresponds to Keser Kahuna. Okay, Kahuna is nicknamed with 24 malos. Well, what are the relevant dimensions of the Mizbech HaKetores? It's an amma by an amma, right? Amma orka, amma rochbo. And an amma, as we said, is six tvachim. And therefore, if you take the six tvachim from each of the sides, six and six and six and six, it gives you 24. Those are the 24 milos of Kahuna. Okay, moving on to the Aron. Now, the length and width of the Aron are referred to as amasayim v'chetzi arko, 2.5 amos long, and amma v'chetzi rochbo, 1.5 amos. Once again, an amma is 6 tvachim, and therefore 2.5 amos, the length, is 15 tvachim. So the 15 and the 15 is 30. And in terms of the width, it's amma v'chetzi, which is 9 tvachim. 9 and 9 is 18. 30 and 18 is 48. Those are the 48 kinyani Torah. Now, before we get comfortable, as we move on to the third kli, which is the shulchan. Now, when it comes to the shulchan, we take a turn, we shift. And the way that it's configured, says Maharal, is no longer with the length and the width, but rather the height and the width. That's very important. And therefore, it was an amma wide, okay, which is again a six tvachim, and it was an amma and a half tall, high. And therefore, if you would look from the side, you have your six wide, right? Six and six is 12. And then you have your two along the height, which is amma v'chetzi, 9 and 9, which is 18. 12 and 18 is 30. Those are the 30 milas of Kahuna. Pardon me, of Malchus. That's it. Now, of course, we will want to know, why is it that when it comes to the Aron and the Mizbeach, we looked upon the relevant dimensions with the length and the width, but when it comes to the Shulchan, it was no longer the length and the width, but rather the height and the width. That seems to be something of a detour. Now the Maharal gives an explanation which is slightly, well, somewhat difficult, obscure, needs to be understood, as is true for much of the Maharal. But I would like to present an answer to this question, which I think is fabulous, from a friend and colleague of mine. His name is Rabbi Jonathan Tau, and he's English, which means it sounds good already. And he says as follows: to understand why it is that for the first two kalim it's the length and width, and for the third kli it's the height and the width, he says very simply, these three institutions of Keser, Kahuna, and Malchus and Torah, they essentially correspond, when you think about it, to the three areas of Torah, Avodah, and Gemilas Hasadim. Torah, of course, Keser Torah is Torah. Kahuna is Avodah. And Malchus essentially taking care of the people, that is the ultimate Gemilas Hasadim. The difference between these three is that the first two are similar to each other. The first two, that is to say, Torah and Avodah, they are in the category called Bein Odom Lamokom, between man and Hashem. The third, Gemilas Chasadim, is Ben Adam Lachaveira, between man and man. And therefore, when we come to consider the appropriate vista to get the relevant dimensions, the relevant measurements, so for the first two, because they are Ben Adam Lamoko, between man and God, therefore we look down on them. We're looking on them from on top, and when you do, you will see from on top the relevant measurements are the length and the width. The third one, Malchus, it's Ben Adam Lachaveira, Ben Adam Lachaveira, therefore the relevant vista is from the side, which means when you look from the side, you'll see the height and the width, and those are the dimensions. A very wonderful insight there. It's the adornment there for the words of the Maharal. And we should know further. This, I believe, will explain to us something else. I would say it's something small and it's something huge at the same time. We refer back again to Pasuk Kaf Gimel. V'asisa shulchan atzei shitim. You shall make a table of cedar wood. Nothing is amiss. Or so it would seem. You see, if we compare, we've mentioned that the Shulchan here is sandwiched between the Aron and the Menorah, Aron before, Menorah afterwards. Have a look at how the Aron is referred to, and have a look at how the Menorah is referred to. The Aron is first, and that's in Pasuk Yud. Pasuk Yud states, V'asu Aron atzei shitim. For us, the significant word there is the word Aron. And the reason why is because, really, the word is Aron. Aron is the R. Why is it stated here, or written here, with Patach? The answer is very simple. Because it's a construct form. It's the Aron of. Aron of Atzei Shitim is written as Aron Atzei Shitim. Every construct, the comments will become a Patach, something of. The word Yod is a hand, but will become Yad Moshe. The word of is a father, but will become Avarachamim, father of, hand of. And therefore, Aron of will become Aron. That's perfect. A very similar thing we'll find with the menorah in Pasuk Lamed Aleph. V'asisa menoras zahav tahor. The word is menorah, of course, but it's written menoras because it's a construct. Menorah of gold, therefore, equals menoras zahav tahor. Having consulted both mimini and mismoli, from before and after, let us return to the Shulchan, and we will now see that something is amiss. Because the Shulchan is also made of atzei shitim. That being the case, the word Shulchan should have been Shulchan atzei shitim. A Shulchan of something becomes Shulchan, like Shulchan Shlomo. So that's very interesting. Easy to pass over. I checked in the... I believe there is no grammatical explanation for this. I checked in the Das Mikra, and there I found it says, There is no grammatical explanation for this. It should be Shulchan. So I found resonance, but of course no assistance. So we are dealing with a grammatical anomaly. Once this cannot be explained based on the rules of grammar, at this point we take recourse to other rules, and then perhaps we will understand. We refer back to a comment of Rabbi Nubachia in Parshas Vayera. And there, he talks about the nikud, the vowelization. And he states that the significance of the vowels, they're not just, quote-unquote, to tell you how to pronounce the word. The vowels of a word are the character of the word. He quotes the Sefer HaBahir, which says the relationship of the vowels to the letters is like the relationship of the neshama to the guf. They're the soul of the word. And because they're the soul of the word, says Rabbeinu Bachya, the way that the word is vowelized tells you something about the nature of that word, about the character of that word. And one example that he quotes is the difference between a komatz and a patach. Komatz and a patach, depending on who you ask, they're pronounced differently, but what is the difference between them, says Rabbeinu Bachya, as surely as the patach itself is flat and the komatz is elevated, so too what the komatz represents is something elevated about the word. And the patach represents something which is somewhat more flat about the words. And it's an incredible way of looking at the nekudos here. And moreover, says Rabbeinu Bachya, this will explain to us one or two things. I'm sure we know them practically, but to understand them thematically. We know that a patach word, for example, when it comes at the end of a pasuk, will change to a komatz. It's called tam mafsik, the pausal form. You find the very same word can feature twice in a pasuk, but when it's at the end, it changes from patach to komatz. The beginning of Parshas Lech Lecha, Avram takes everyone, Vayetzu laleches arza kena'an, Vayavo arza kena'an. Kena'an became kena'an. Why? Is it easier to say? I don't know that it is. Is it for felicity of pronunciation? Not sure. Says Rabbeinu Bachya, when it's at the end of the pasuk, it completes the pasuk. And as the word that completes the pasuk, it has a certain aspect of chashivus, a certain aspect of shleimus. Whenever something comes at the end, it's the final, it's the makkah bepatish, it has a certain significance, a certain gravity that otherwise it might not have if it was just stam in the middle. And you see it, to borrow a word from our parlance, it's upgraded from a patach word to a komatz word as it becomes the dover hamashlim. Fascinating. The converse can also be true, says Rabbeinu Bachya. Sometimes a komatz word can become a patach word. For example, we've already quoted, in the construct form, the word yod can become yad, and ov can become av. Komatz becomes a patach. What happened? Says Rabbeinu Bachya, consider. The difference grammatically between these two is that if it's a construct form, then it's relying on another word to explain it. And therefore it's lost its dependence. In his words, it's somech al shulchan acherim. It's dependent on another word. Anything that's dependent, it loses its significance, and therefore that's measured by being downgraded, in a sense now, from a komatz to a patach. So all of a sudden, these rules which we're aware of practically, to see, in a sense, what's inside of them, what it means to change from a komatz to a patach, or from a patach to a komatz. Now, thus far, our discussion is relatively contained. And the reason why is because all we've done is we've taken rules of grammar and given something of an innerness to them, a primus explanation. But the rules are the same. However, says Rabbeinu Bachya, you will find sometime that this characterization through the vowels, it doesn't explain the rules of grammar. It breaks the rules of grammar. Because if the character of the word is so antithetical with what the word is, what the pronunciation, it will change it in spite of the rules of grammar. It's an eruption. For example, so Rabbi Nebuchadnezzar directs our attention to the beginning of Sefer Shmuel Beis. What is happening there? At the end of Shmuel Aleph, there was the war. Shaul and his sons were killed. In the beginning of Shmuel Beis, David and his men are waiting. They're waiting for word for Shaul. No one knows what happened. Now, there was someone who was referred to as a Ger Amaleki, which is an interesting discussion in itself, what exactly that means. But he came, he was something of an opportunist, because he knew that no one knew what had happened. He also knew that David and Shaul had tensions between them. He knew that Shaul at times had been chasing after David to kill him. He therefore made the following decision, or calculation. He assumed that David would be as happy to hear about Shaul's death as Shaul would be looking to kill David, and therefore he presented himself as the one that killed Shaul, thinking that that would give him a place in David's cabinet. So he comes along, and he says that it was terrible, and they were everywhere, and we were surrounded, outnumbered, and Shaul was there, and he was Va'emod alav, I stood over him, Va'amosasehu, and I killed him. Now that wasn't true. But that's what he said, thinking that he would be rewarded. As it was, David killed him for killing Shaul. So, in retrospect, it didn't do very well for him, but that's neither here nor there. So these are his words, for Emod alav va'avosas va'amosas sehu. Says Rabbi Nebuchadnezzar, consider. The word va'amosa sehu is not written the way it should be. And the reason why is because it's the vava hipuch, right? I did. But before one of those guttural letters, like the aleph and the ayin, and etc., it shouldn't be a patach, it should be a komatz. Like, for example, va'amodalov, not va'amodalov, va'amodalov, the vava hipuch, the vav conjunctive, pardon me, conversive, before one of those gutturals, be a komatz. So as surely as the correct vowelization is Vo'e'emodalav, so too it should have said Vo'amosasehu, not Va'amosasehu. That's incorrect. Why then is it written with a patach and a written? Bachia's answer is unbelievable. He says the reason why it's written with a patach is because there is no way that the pasuk will award a komatz to this word, because it doesn't deserve it. A komatz represents some aspect of chashivas. This was a barefaced lie. So he has lost on moral grounds what he should have had on grammatical grounds. And here you see the two are now in conflict. Pure grammar says should be a komatz. The emes says, or ruchnius says, this word cannot take a comma. You can't have a comma in a word like that. It's the most despicable word you could imagine. And therefore it gets demoted. It is a virtual comma, a virtual patter. That's one for the books. Because here we see that sometimes if you see what seems to be a grammatical anomaly, it's the pnimius of the vowels. And now, when we come back to our Shulchan, and we saw something that seems a bit off. Vasisa Shulchan at Seishitim. Our question is, it's a construct, and which it is. Construct means it should be a patach. Why does a word that should have a patach nonetheless have a komatz? The answer is, sometimes the vowelization of the word is governed and dictated by the nature of the word. What's the Shulchan all about? Or what are Rashi's words? Loshon Keser Malchus, Shulchan, Shem Osher, Ugedula, Shulchan Malachim. The very essence of the Shulchan is about kingship, royalty, greatness. The word that bespeaks of that greatness will retain a komatz which represents that greatness, even if grammar says it should have gone down to a patach. That is my suggestion in terms of what otherwise it would be, it's seemingly until further notice, impossible to explain up here, dikduk. And so, We discussed some aspects of the Shulchan. Of course, it has many appurtenances, and the Lechem Aponim, which Mitzvah Hashem will have to leave for another time. But I would like to conclude with a beautiful insight in the name of Rev. Reuven Grozovsky. Rev. Reuven Grozovsky was a son-in-law of the great Baruch Be'er of Kamenitz, and he was a Rosh Hashiva. He came from Litta to America. He was a Rosh Hashiva in Torah Vadas then, and of the Gedolim. And in a sense, it will help us to bring the Shulchan, or lesson from the Shulchan. And of course, the Mishkan is all about lessons from the Mishkan. That's really, that's what they're there for. In fact, the Abarbanel says that the essence of the Mishkan really is to be pondered for its lessons. It's not just, and that's how he explains why the Torah gives so many details. This should be like this, and it should be like this. This amount of Tochen, that amount of Tochen. Everything is a lesson. And that's why study of the Mishkan ultimately is essentially a study of how to be Jewish. That's how he explains the opening pasuk of the Haftorah of Parshas Tetzaveh, which is from Yechezkel Perik Mem Gimel. It's not every year that we get to have the Haftorah from Tetzaveh. Sometimes it gets taken over by Zohar. But the opening pasuk says, Ata ben Adam, Haged es beis Yisrael es habayis. Tell the people, tell them about the bias. They should be ashamed of their averus. They'll measure. They should measure the form. What does that mean? How does telling them about the house and measuring the form, how does that lead to shame for over shortcomings? Says the Barbanel, because there's a message from every measurement. There's a call. And therefore, when the Jewish people aren't being as they should, you can either exhort them explicitly. But if they have a sense of what the Beis HaMikdash is, just to talk to them about the Beis HaMikdash, that alone should bring, if they're yet sensitive, they should realize they're not, they have the failing to respond to that measurement and that form and that item. And therefore, Pasuk Kaf Gimel discussed the Shulchan. Pasuk Kaf Dalet discusses the crown, and then Kaf Hei, another aspect of the Shulchan, Masisolo Misgeres, Tofach Saviv. Then you make an enclosure, some type of a perimeter, really, for the Shulchan. Vasisa Zerzav LeMiskarta Saviv. Make a crown for the Miskaret. There's a Shaila in the Gemara, actually, as to whether there are two crowns on the Mishkan, on the Shulchan, one for the table, one for the Miskaret. Rashi sides here with the understanding that there is only one Zer. It goes around the Miskaret. Says Reb Reuven, the Shulchan, as we've seen, it's about kingship, royalty, greatness, wealth. When does a person have that? It's a good shaila. For many, the answer is not yet. And yet Pirkei Avos has told us that the secret to wealth, and the more one ponders it, the more the inescapable truth. Eizehu Ashir HaSameach B'chelko. You just need to be aware that you have everything that you need. Which means the crown of kingship, which represents greatness and wealth and all of that and success, the crown goes on top of the miskeret. The miskeret is an enclosure. That is to say, a person gets the crown of royalty when he has a sense of an enclosure. He has a sense that he has everything that he needs. As long as the table's open, so you can extend. And maybe there's more. The secret to the crown of royalty, Ezehu Asher Samech Bechelko. You're complete. I have everything I need. If you have that, you have the crown of royalty. That's, of course, a lesson well worth taking to heart from the Shulchan. We'll leave our discussions of the Mishkan over here for this evening. And Mitzvah Hashem, next week, we'll pick up with the first of our sessions on Megillas Esther and Purim.